renegotiating the union contract to allow contemporaneous interviewing of officers after a shooting, and prohibition of the supervising RU commander serving as a voting member of the police review board. We urge you to pay particular attention to these and other recommendations inspired by outside experts, supported by the community and the CRC, and reconsider your conclusions. Thank you again for your attention to this issue.
Thank you for your testimony. Thank you all. We really appreciate it. All right.
The next four are David Fedenke, Elmira Rodriguez, Moses Rosen, and Alisa Kevwood.
And then after them,
Sally Joglin, Suzanne Hayden, Jim Linkus, and Byron Parman.
Great. They're up next. Mr. Fedenke, welcome back.
Thank you. David Fedenke, Executive Director of the ACLU of Oregon. As Mr. Mayor and Commissioners, I assume you're all aware that our former legislative director, Andrea Meyer, was part of the stakeholder group. And I believe we endorsed all of the findings and recommendations of the stakeholder group. I just want to focus on two, and I also want to join the comments that were made previously by the previous four folks who testified. The purpose of the CRC and the IPR process is to increase public confidence, not just public confidence, in the system for reviewing complaints against police officers, but also to improve police policies and practices so they better reflect the values of this community. And that is the piece that the CRC has been having the most difficulty with in my experience. It has wanted a larger role on these policy issues because so many times in instances of allegations of police misconduct, the policies involved are so broad and grant so much discretion to individual officers and so little practical guidance that there is no violation of policy. It is the policies themselves that are the problem. And while the auditor and the director of IPR are recommending to you today in this ordinance that role be made more explicit, we want to underscore that for you all, because the practices of adopting policy in the Portland Police Bureau have not been transparent. They have been extremely opaque and have had far less public involvement and public input than we believe they should, to get the best policies in place that will provide officers the guidance that they want and need in doing their job day to day, to know that their actions reflect the values of this community. The other issue I wanted to underscore is this issue of the standard of evidence in appeals before the CRC. The recommendation by the stakeholder committee and by others, including the CRC itself, to change that standard to preponderance of the evidence was made by consensus of the stakeholder committee. You have seen it, and there was not consensus on all of their recommendations, but that was one where no one disagreed. And I think you've already heard today that the current standard is extremely weak and, as a practical matter, just causes confusion for both the CRC and members of the public that come before the CRC as an independent body looking for an independent view of the evidence that has been uncovered. And That's all I have to say. Thank you all very much.
Thanks, Mr. Vedenke. Hi, welcome.
Hello, good afternoon. My name is Elmira Rodriguez. This last Saturday evening, while acting as a peacekeeper for the AccuFest that happened, I was assaulted by an Officer Bryant. While I went to collect my emotions after the assault, I went to seek out the individual who assaulted me and get his name. I found him on the steps of the Justice Center, and he turned his back to me once he saw me and refused to give me his name. A group of approximately four officers encircled my abuser and also turned their backs to me and ignored my request for his name. Since I found that I was not going to get anywhere with these gentlemen, I went to seek out a supervisor, and I found Lieutenant Chris Davis, who, after 5 minutes of discussion with Officer Bryant, convinced him and forced him to give me his name and his employee ID number. With this, I felt like I had an avenue to pursue to hold this abuser accountable. But shortly after I left their presence and before I was out of earshot and eyesight, Lieutenant Davis turned to Officer Bryant and embraced the man and jokingly told him he's got to stop making trouble. I left that feeling extremely defeated and knowing that I have no recourse when I am abused by an officer. And I am here today to tell you that the public all over feels this way. We feel like we have no way to hold the gentlemen who abuse us accountable while they are acting as police officers. That is the only thing I need to say today. Thank you.
I encourage you to file a complaint.
Well, they jokingly told me, well, they had their backs to me, that I should file a complaint. And I told them that I needed the officer's name to be able to do that.
That part. At the end of your testimony, I'm encouraging you to file a complaint.
Thank you.
Sir.
Hello, my name is Moses Rosen. I'm a member of Everyday People. I was seated at the table at the community stakeholders meetings and am a founding member of Occupy Portland. In the ordinance, the council finds, and I agree with the city believes that an effective police force requires the community's trust and confidence. Does the police have this trust and confidence? I say the answer is unequivocally no. And if you don't believe me, ask 81-year-old Jack Mongeon, who was abused and arrested for doing nothing more than standing on the sidewalk. The city feels that, or the auditor and the IPR director find that this ordinance and the update that's being reviewed today is an important step in increasing the public's confidence in police accountability, and I would agree with that. It is one important step, and we have about three more miles to go. For context, it should be noted that on September 1st, 2010, City Council enacted changes to the Independent Police Review Ordinance. These changes significantly increased the amount of community oversight and complaint handling and discipline process. Earlier that year, we had a brutal murder at the hands of a police officer. In November, that officer was fired. And because of the actions of the Police Officers Association, that murderer is up to get his job back and back pay. I'm just going to skip to the end here, cut to the chase. Mayor Adams, you said in an introductory memorandum letter to the commissioners and the auditor that you emphasize that the submission of this report does not signify an end to our commitment to continuous improvement. Chief Reese and I are committed to maintaining and improving the PPB's relationship with community groups, oversight organizations, stakeholders to ensure that the PPB is public safety agency that represents the values of Portland. I would ask for 30 more seconds.
Sure.
Thank you. I think that the brutal beating of Justin Bridges on Sunday morning is an opportunity for the city to hold itself accountable and for the police department to hold itself accountable. This is a high-profile use of force, and it deserves much attention. Justin Bridges is still in a wheelchair. He spent a couple of days in the hospital, and if you look at the videos, which everybody can see on YouTube, he was completely compliant. This needs to change, and not a year from now.
Thank you. Hi. Welcome.
Hi. My name is Elisa Kerwood. I am one of your many disabled people. I have cerebral palsy, so it takes me a little more time for me to say what I gotta say. Okay, that said, here's a question for you, Mayor Adams. Why the billy clubs that were used Sunday morning, thank you. That were used in the park, because most of those people were not armed. One more thing, but it's kind of like when somebody brings a gun to a fist fight. That's all I have to say.
Thank you for your testimony. Appreciate it. Thank you all.
Thank you.
Next four are Sally Joglin, Suzanne Hayden, Jim Linkus, and Brian Parman. And they'll be followed by Daniel Forbes, Rochelle Silver, Lori Benoit, and Troy Thompson.
Hi, welcome. Glad you're here.
Sally Jockin from Portland. I was honored to be a part of the stakeholder committee representing one of the organizations because I thought I might be able to help speak for other citizens and help make some improvements. And we had over a dozen meetings, including many special meetings that I chose to attend, where we clarified language and meaning so that the general meetings would be easier to understand. And as you know, we came up with a long list of over 150 recommendations for improvements through a very thorough democratic process. And I was surprised to learn later that only a small number of these recommendations were acceptable, particularly to some individuals who were at the general meetings and chose not to fully participate in the discussions, but later they didn't favor quite a few of these recommendations. So it has made me wonder, you know, why I spent all those hours in all those meetings to craft the recommendations thinking that the majority of them would be accepted, and seems that that's not the case, at least so far. The people of Portland expect citizen oversight, and I don't think that transparency and review are enough to gain the citizen trust that everybody says that they want. And although, yes, police should be investigating themselves, that should not be the only oversight that happens. The public just doesn't accept that, and particularly when violence occurs. So I made a sign. It is from Occupy. It's, it says you can't evict an idea whose time has come. So, you know, it's not, it's related to what has been happening recently, but I think it's very relevant to this police improvement process, because I really feel that the time has come. I've been hearing complaints from the public here and in the city that I lived in before I moved here a few years ago. The public just doesn't accept it if there isn't any citizen voice and citizen review of what the police are doing, no matter how good a police force you have. the public has to be involved, and especially when violence occurs. But really, all the time, the public should be involved. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Appreciate your testimony. Hi, welcome.
Good afternoon, Mayor Adams and City Council members. I'm Suzanne Hayden. I'm the Executive Director of the Citizens Crime Commission, and I'm also a longtime Portland resident. I'd like to thank all the organizations and individuals who've engaged in this important discussion involving public safety, and I'd like to limit my comments and offer support today for just one of the specific recommendations in the report, and that is support for scenario-based training capabilities for the Portland Police Bureau, and in particular, support of the required political, community, and financial dedication for a regional training facility. I've worked with police officers my entire professional career as a Multnomah County District Attorney, and over the years, district attorneys, including myself, have trained with the Portland Police Bureau officers in multiple locations, including Camp Rylea, which is on the coast, Camp Karatli in Barton, the Clackamas County Sheriff's Facility, the Justice Center, Camp Withicum, and two school buildings that were no longer in use, just to name a few. The logistical nightmare and inefficient use of resources pose a serious concern. However, until I attended the Community Academy that was put on by the Portland Police Bureau, I was not fully aware of the negative impact on the actual quality of training such far-flung and inadequate locations have on our men and women who are police officers. During this academy, we participated in scenario training at Camp Withicum, and which is no longer available for the Police Bureau to use. And scenario training approximates the real-life situations that officers are encountering on the streets every day. And it uses driving, crisis intervention training, techniques, defensive tactics, and firearms. The Portland Police Bureau is the largest police agency in the state, and we have the most population density and the highest calls for service, but we have no dedicated location for officers to simultaneously and effectively use all these disciplines. So, as we are aware, encounters with police and citizens that go badly, the number one focus is on failures in training and tactics. And we as a community need to support public safety and the dedicated men and women who serve on our police bureau with the necessary resources and facilities to provide the critical training that they need. Thank you very much for your leadership in this matter.
Thank you, sir.
Mayor Adams and Council, I'm Jim Linkus. I'm here also to speak on behalf of the consideration of a training facility. I'm currently Vice President and General Manager of iOWEST and also serve on the Board of Directors of the Citizens Crime Commission, which is really focused on public safety advocacy. And I also serve on the Executive Board of the Software Association of Oregon, which represents about 450 of Oregon's top software technologies businesses, not only here in Portland, but also in the state of Oregon. My relationship with the Portland Police Bureau began really about 3.5 years ago with the tragic death of my very close friend, Portland Police Officer Mark Zalawi, also known as Z-Man, who served the citizens of Portland, specifically out in North Portland, for his most of his career. I think he was out there about 14 years. I also went through the Citizen Academy about 2 years ago, and we had a very interesting and knowledgeable training, which really significantly highlighted my awareness, though, for the need of high-quality training for our police officers. You know, as we participated, we were instructed in various disciplines, such as the shooting and defense tactics, and also quite a bit on less than lethal force options. But really what brought it home was my experience in the training scenarios. We approached a woman in a mental crisis with a knife holding it to her throat and also to a domestic violence scenario. Even though we knew it was a simulation, my eyes were truly open to the many types of unpredictable, potentially life-threatening situations that our law enforcement professionals may encounter each and every day when they go out on the street. It was valuable to work through them, debrief afterwards, and then to realize it's imperative that officers have the best possible training that we can provide. Why build a training facility? I think the number one reason is today they have no place to train. As Suzanne shared, Camp Withicum is gone now, so our officers are forced to go all around town and basically do what they can do, where they can go. but it's really not adequate for the job we're asking them to do. And furthermore, they're required by state law to have X number of hours. I don't know what the exact number is, but I think it's 30-plus hours of training a year for ongoing. With 400,000 citizen contacts annually by the Portland Police Bureau, half of those being 911 calls, again, I think it's very important that they get trained in tactics and just policies in general to be able to train in an area that it's more efficient. The other fact is that Oregon, out of 18,000 law enforcement agencies in the United States today, is the 30th largest, and we don't have a training facility. Again, it's amazing, a city of this size, but also an agency the size of the city of Portland has is very, very underserved on that. Why does the business community recommend building a dedicated training facility? Really to support the public safety professionals in making Portland a safe environment to live, to work, to visit, and also to raise our families. Training is critical to not only officer safety, but also to community safety, I think, as we've heard over and over. And last but not least is really around efficiencies and cost consolidations. It just, as a business person, it just doesn't make a lot of sense to travel all over and not have an area that's dedicated to training. So thank you very much for your consideration.
Thank you. Sir.
Good afternoon, Mr. Mayor, member of council. My name is Brian Parman. I'm currently the captain of the training division for the Portland Police Bureau. I'm also the association president of the Portland Police Commanding Officers Association, and lastly, a longtime resident of the city of Portland. I want to talk today about the training facility first and then the report in general. Many of the recommendations in this report can point back to a need for improving the quality of the training that we give to our officers. As outlined by Mrs. Hayden and Mr. Linkus, we have several barriers to providing effective and meaningful training to our officers. I have a top-notch training staff at my disposal, and they are able to put together incredible training, but all the training we currently develop is limited in scope by the facilities that we can lease, rent, squat in, if you will. We have this this approach has forced us to fracture our programs and focus more on delivering skills than to really focus on critical thinking. By combining all of our skills into a dedicated facility which we could control and change and modify as the needs of our organization change, we'll be able to deliver effective and meaningful scenario-based training that really will help us get at the core of effective police service, and that's critical thinking under extreme circumstances in an environment that we can control. So I would strongly recommend that council consider moving forward and continue trying to locate a training facility for the police bureau. In general, as far as the rest of the report, we believe that the report outlines measurable steps which have been taken by the police bureau to increase transparency and improve the quality of civilian oversight. As the managers that I represent, we're all supportive of the changes implemented by the police bureau, and we believe that all the steps that have already been taken are all steps in the right direction. However, given the number of changes already implemented, we recommend that council consider taking time to evaluate the effectiveness of these steps before pursuing additional change within the police bureau. Thank you very much for your time.
Thanks, Captain. Thank you all. Appreciate your testimony.
The next four are Daniel Forbes, Rochelle Silver, Lori Benoit, and Troy Thompson, and they'll be followed by Sylvia Zingizers, I believe is the last name, and T.J. Browning.
Hi, welcome. Thanks for waiting. We have our fourth person. Ms. Browning, do you want to come forward then? We have an extra seat. Sir, would you like to begin?
Yes. Thank you to the mayor and the council, and excuse my cold. My name is Daniel Forbes. I've published widely in many publications you've heard of and caused congressional hearings with my work and testified before the U.S. House and the Senate pitted against White House officials. I say that only because what I'm about to say is based on personal observation. I'd like to talk about what I witnessed as Saturday turned to Sunday regarding the dangerous use of mounted police. It became apparent that the police bureau's first objective was to try to push thousands of demonstrators out of Main Street, Southwest Main. Slowly, inexorably, five or six mounted police, their number absurdly inadequate to try to move a crowd of thousands, pushed and probed to no avail. dozens of horse might have achieved the police objective in this, but not five or six. Again and again, mounted officers abused dumb animals, reeling, probing, pushing, at one point for some reason, even trying to make the poor animals back tail first into the crowd. Maybe that was the only way to bend the horses to their will, to keep the horses from seeing what they were being asked to do. Then someone on occupied side of the line threw a bottle, what looked like an empty plastic bottle, but perhaps was not, and a very small flare-type item. The crowd offered him up to the police for arrest, proving itself indeed a nonviolent movement. But my point here today, what if a horse fell, maybe broke a leg and had to be destroyed like on the spot, like at a racetrack? Would an officer unbuckle his sidearm in front of all those cameras and do the deed? And from the other point of view, what if an occupier fell? This was a very intense scene. 5,000 people, the Oregonian estimates. What if a horse reeled, kicked demonstrators in the face, then bolted towards us as a terrified crowd suddenly trampled those behind? I interviewed a 31-year-old Marine vet by the name of Aaron Collier. He said the crowd was so thick he was in the front, quote, "I could not have backed up had I wanted to." This was a heck of a nice little game of chicken, this little cavalry display. I'm almost done. Whether to achieve something or just a dangerous exercise in intimidation. Collier added the only thing he felt he could do was to place his hands upon the enormous animal clad in metal shoes that was thrusting against him. Still, the horses kept coming, but eventually the occupation held. I think that this policy, I saw horses outside on Main Street as I came here today. This needs to be considered again.
Thank you, sir.
Thank you.
Thanks for testifying. Ma'am.
Good afternoon. My name is Rochelle Silver, and I am a current member of the Citizen Review Committee, serving for almost 3 years now. This afternoon, I'd like to talk to you about one item that is not in the report coming forward as a recommendation, but that you've heard about several times today, and that's the standard of review that the Citizen Review Committee currently is working under. As you know, that standard of review is the reasonable person standard, and we all, nine of us, are unanimous in our wish that you consider changing that to preponderance of evidence. The reason for that is simply the reasonable person standard does not work, it is not reasonable, and it is not accomplishing what civilian review is intended for. And I can give you an example, a current example. There is an appeal before us now. We had a case file review meeting last week, at which time the CRC members, asked for a photograph that was not present in the internal affairs file. The Internal Affairs Department agreed to get that photograph for us, and in getting that, we'll be interviewing several more witnesses that they did not interview the first time. That changes all the information that is then coming to our committee. But if we use the reasonable person standard, what we are doing is charged with deciding whether the commander made a reasonable person decision in coming up with his or her findings given the information he or she had at the time. But since we have new and different information, that standard seems, excuse me, ridiculous. I would strongly encourage you, please, to consider changing that standard. Thank you.
May I ask a question?
Yeah.
Rochelle is my liaison to the CRC, and I really appreciate your frequent briefing. So I would appreciate your opinion on the record as far as what's your response to those who say that changing it to the preponderance of the evidence would mean that the CRC would become a new separate review body trying the case over again?
Well, to be honest with you, Commissioner, it is that. Because when the appellant and the officers and the union and witnesses come before us during the appeal hearing, information that may have not been, wasn't at all heard in the original investigation or is said differently or described differently, makes the case different. And given that we hear that information, we can't pretend we didn't hear that information. And our job is to decide whether the officer or officers involved were within or not within policy, given the information that we hear and read and see. And that is sometimes, and I must say frequently, different than the information that the commander had at the time that they made their decision.
So what you and others are saying is that, yes, you should be able to be a second review body?
I believe, yes.
Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. Hi, thanks for waiting.
Hello, my name is Lori Benoit. I have lived in Portland, went to Buckman School as well as other schools in the state, graduated, have a bachelor's degree in management. I'm an occupied Portland person. I agree with the first gentleman about the horses. They were also used at Jameson Square, where I was arrested and during a peaceful protest there. And I can tell you that the police have been extremely violent. I was injured at that park, and after I was taken into custody on October 30th, and it's what the police are doing to us is it's unconscionable. They're terrorizing us and torturing us. There was a 16-year-old who was and his sister, 17-year-old, who were in the same van that I was, and I watched, you know, how what they did to him, and he was saying he was a minor. And saying he was 16-year-old, and the things that they did to him and said to him should never be done to, you know, anybody, much less, you know, a 16-year-old, somebody, you know, who kept telling him that he was only a minor. And the things that they had to, that they did to us when they terrorized us, as well as the things that they said should never be done to anybody. And I think that Portland has a bad reputation for their police force. I had never seen it firsthand. I had never been arrested. I had never been in a jail until that particular day. And I am very sad to say that it was not a good situation. It's the only time in my whole life that I thought I was going to die. And it's bad.
And thank you for your testimony. Have you filed a complaint?
I have not.
There's folks who can help you.
Thank you.
Ms. Browning?
Thank you. Good afternoon. I'm not going to go through what I've done. It'll take all my 3 minutes and then some. But 20 years ago when I got started in this arena, I made a trip to Northwestern. I had read a publication by Werner Pedersen, who was at the time with the Justice Department, advocating civilian review boards. And it was kind of a new animal at that time. And so I went back to talk to him. He was very generous with his time. His job at the Justice Department was to go into cities that had been, police departments had been taken over by the Justice Department. His number one job was to restore trust between the Bureau and the community they served. He told me in no uncertain terms his most potent tool he had to do that was a civilian review board. Now, he didn't go into me about what types or how to set them up, but he knew that if you're going to bring trust to the Bureau, a civilian review board was the most effective way of doing it. Now, move ahead several years ago. We got rid of PIAC, which was an auditing system, started marching towards a civilian review board, primarily on the basis that we are a community policing agency. We all talk the talk. We're all very proud that we're a community policing agency. But one of the four major components of a community policing agency is accountability, and it is considered a cornerstone no matter how you research it. We need an effective system that's trusted. As long as the police investigate their police, it's not going to be trusted. And I'm not saying anything bad against our bureau. It is human nature to protect those we surround ourselves with. We all understand human nature. And to expect them to go contrary to human nature is not something the normal person on the street would agree with. Secondly, the reasonable person standard. I don't think it will muddle the lines at all. I think it will actually sharpen the lines and make everybody's understanding of the situation a lot more clearer. You know, we can all agree in this room on one thing, and that's that we all want a professional police force. The police want to be treated as professionals and considered professionals. You all want to have a police force that's professional, as do the citizens. We owe it to the police bureau to have a system in place that can be trusted by the public, and we owe it to the public to give them a system that they can trust. It is a win-win situation. Please look at those recommendations, but the review of a standard of review and the police investigating the police are two of the major things that I think really need to be addressed.
Thank you. Thanks for your testimony.
Is there a Troy Thompson? Okay, then we have a Sylvia, and I'm sorry, I'm not sure the last name.
Last person.
Zinga, sir, thank you. And also we had two people who didn't get to sign up who asked to speak.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, you can come on up.
Yeah, come on up. Anyone else? We have one final chair. Ma'am, please begin.
I'm Sylvia Zingaser. I'm a member of National Alliance on Mental Illness for Multnomah County, and I also sit on the Crisis Intervention Training Advisory Board representing NAMI Multnomah. And I'd like to speak personally as well as for NAMI. I do support Reverend Haynes, the AMA, and Dan Handelman. I think that there's been a lot of testimony that's been very clear and well thought out. It's been interesting to hear that the police department has people here recommending training facility. I would say that probably that's probably needed. I would support that. The other thing that I would support and would hope that everybody would consider along with that is a quality assurance program that would help measure how the police department is conducting their work. And they would be able to find the systems problems that are not working. It's not meant to be policing themselves. And I think that Commissioner Fritz understands how quality assurance, so if you need to know more about that, she could probably explain that to you. Thank you for this opportunity, and let's be a new Portland and change the paradigm and do community policing and look to do things differently and be supportive of the police as well as the community and get back to some real community policing. Thank you.
Thanks for your testimony.
You're welcome.
Hi, welcome.
Hello, my name is Erica Rothman, and I'm a member of the National Lawyers Guild. I'm on the Portland Chapter Policy Board. I'm also on the National Executive Committee representing Oregon and Idaho. And I would like to follow up on a few things that Ashley Albies did not get to. So the citizen oversight process, albeit marginally improved on account of the new ordinance, remains fatally flawed. There are no independent investigations. There is an adequate review. Review the reviewers as opposed to fact-finding process in the CRC. But what I'm going to emphasize is that the IPR cannot compel officers to cooperate with the IPR's investigations. Now, the collective bargaining process still limits the IPR's authority to compel officer cooperation. The city has asserted that granting IPR authority to compel officer testimony is a mandatory bargaining subject. However, the Oregon courts have not yet decided this issue. Oregon's Employment Relations Board determines whether bargaining subjects are mandatory or permissive by weighing the management prerogatives against the employee interests. Last year, the ERB decided the Eugene Police Employees Association versus City of Eugene, which came close to but didn't reach the issue of whether granting an auditor authority to conduct investigatory interviews is a permissive or a mandatory subject. The board chair's concurrence in the Eugene Police Employees Association and prior ERB cases indicate that this subject would likely be permissive and that is a subject the city may bargain about. It is very important that the city not be making public policy in the context of a collective bargaining agreement with the police union. It's simply not transparent to work it this way. Now, a point that Ms. Albies touched on that I'd like to reiterate, but in the context of a lack of transparency, is the overwhelming number of community recommendations ignored in the process of sort of winnowing down these recommendations essentially amounts to the city ignoring the voice of the people without at least a greater explanation as to why these recommendations fall off the table. And when the city looks at the voice of the people and sort of narrows that with less of an eye toward explaining why, the people take to the streets. You could argue that Occupy Portland suggests that, but I think a better parallel, because the Occupy is a national movement and that this is an outgrowth of, would be the JTTF protests, the protests in response to the revisiting the JTTF resolution we saw earlier this spring. So, and finally, as Ms. Albies suggested, locking the doors to City Hall during this meeting reflects the city's recalcitrance to face the public on this matter, and we have an opportunity, as many folks have said, to sort of move forward with transparency, and I'd like to add my voice to that pile. Thank you for the opportunity.
If I could just comment on that, the mayor and I barely got inside City Hall, and the reason for that was not that we don't want the public in here. It was the demonstration that was going on outside, and it's an interesting conflict of different freedoms of speeches that the demonstration that was going on in the streets and beside the streets meant it was more difficult for other citizens to get inside into this extremely important hearing. So it's not that we didn't want people here. There's other things going on, and that I hope that everyone is considering everybody else's civil rights as we move forward, figuring out the next steps for Occupy and for our whole community. I hope, particularly tomorrow morning, I'm going to take this advantage of being on television right now to let citizens know that if they're trying to get to work or get their kids to daycare tomorrow, that this steel bridge is likely to not be as functional as it usually is. And so buses, light rail, and others will be disrupted. So I have had emails from cab drivers who have said they've had to turn off the meter because they're stuck in traffic because of people exercising their lawful rights to free speech and free assembly. So I just want us all to consider that each of our behavior has impacts on others' rights as well. And so I'm not saying that anyone or other, particularly Trump's, but I do want you to know that it was not. Our hope was that we would have had more folks being able to get to this hearing so that they could give us their input. We also, as the mayor has said, we're not voting on this today. We're not even voting on it next week. So there's going to be other opportunities, both for public hearing and certainly for public testimony. This is a very complicated issue. There are many, many details within both of the ordinances today. So those are not things that you can really express very well in 3 minutes. I've probably spent 3 minutes here trying to explain all of this. So we do welcome citizens spending more time and giving us more details in writing, because we will certainly consider that. But thank you for making the point.
Thank you for the explanation.
What was ignored?
Ignored is the shorthand that Ashley used when she whispered to me. But we know the stakeholders came presented a passel of recommendations, 150, I think, and those have been winnowed down, some with more explanation than others, and that's merely what I was trying to voice.
Okay. Hi, welcome.
Hello, I'm Edith Gillis, and yesterday when I came, there were no protesters blocking the way. There were security guards blocking the way. There's only one door open at a time. The security guard kept at least 5-10 minutes to prevent me from coming in to deliver a proposed ordinance. there were many ways to stop me from coming in, and police outside being intimidating is one of those. I don't buy the excuse to prevent folks from participating, and I hope you encourage folks to participate or you'll lose legitimacy. The reason I came is because one of the quickest, cheapest, safest, easiest, and most credible ways in which you can have more trust and credibility and stay in office and have tax dollars is that you simply have on every police officer, and particularly every officer, no matter what agency, whether a military, whether a private contractor, whether they're from another country, anyone wearing riot gear in the city limits must abide by the following or not be allowed to participate and would be subject to immediate arrest and their loss of pay or benefit, and their employer or contractor would not get paid and would be subject to not being hired again. For example, on the chest and on the back, 3 inches high, 1/4 inch thick lines, white fluorescent, their number and their name, top of their helmet, over the forehead, not blocking their view, the back of their head, their number. On their back, 3 inches with 1/4 inch lines. On their shoulder, upper arms, away from the upper arm guard, in plain view, again, their number and their last name. On the boot at different angles, the number. 3 inches from the end of the baton or the club would be their ID number. At the bottom of the shield would be their last name and ID number. This would not impede the police safety. It would not impede the safety of the civilians who are trying to demonstrate their responsibilities under the Constitution. It would not allow the kind of situation where this dear woman had to find out who was the criminal attacking her. It would not put in danger the police who are trying to be good cops and are being subject to bribery or harassment or extortion or endangerment because they would tell the truth. They don't have to necessarily tell on each other or be excluded from telling on each other because the numbers would be fluorescent, they would be clear, they'd be visible to security cameras and to others, and anyone who did not have that would be removed or be subject. A baton raised above the crowd, as I saw many times Sunday afternoon, could be identified as who was the criminal attacking someone.
Thanks for your testimony. Appreciate it, sir.
Thank you. My name is Andrew Crosby, and I have general comments, not technical comments, about the different reports that were submitted. I'm a lifelong Oregonian. I moved my family to Portland about a year ago from Bend, and I'm really loving this city, and one of the qualities that comes forward in my experience of this city is that it has a softness and an inclusivity about it that is pretty unique among cities around the United States. And it seems that the community here tries to recognize and involve all different constituents. The homeless are us. Occupiers are us. It's not sort of the city powers versus those with less power and less voice. And that fosters a creativity and a sense of community and a sense of functionality, which really makes this place a wonderful city to live in. And the rest of the cities around the country and around the world seem to be heading towards more of a police state model with very overpowered police forces that seem to be gearing up against some impending threat. More power, more armor, more weaponry. And, you know, Portland sort of sits at this juncture, it seems, right now with the symbolism of the Occupy movement bringing this out, that there will be change, and this community is trying to change right now, as is our whole national community. And as it does that, there's going to be restlessness. People are going to be turning out in the streets, and I can guarantee you, just by what I see, there's going to be more of that. It's just going to be the way of the world for a while here. And so we have a choice as to whether we view what's happening as us or as something that we have to defend against. And my view is, and it seems like the view and the tone of the city is that when we show up for peaceful protest, that's us out there, right? When we're somebody who's crossing a line that maybe we shouldn't, that's us too. And as us, that empowers a police force, it seems that we need to decide how and when we want that police force to act. Do we want it to taser us? Well, if yes, under what circumstances? Do we want it to ride horses and wear armor and shields and carry batons into a peaceful assembly? Well, if so, what are the conditions of that? The only way that you can get to an intelligent framework for what those conditions are around how we police ourselves as a community is by having very serious, credible, detailed citizen input, which this committee has provided the CRC, and that then you take the time to listen to and to incorporate into your findings. So I would echo a lot of the good sense recommendations that I've heard here today. Seems like there are quite a few on the table that perhaps the auditor dismissed. Seems like maybe there's a sense that they were summarily or casually dismissed. So I would encourage you, please, take your time, take a look at those. Do everything you can at this juncture to ensure that our police force is everyone's police force, right? And that's good for police as well.
Thank you, sir.
It really is. Thank you.
Appreciate your comments. Thank you all for your testimony. All right. So that is our first hearing on these two items. We pick this up again on whatever date I said. No, the second hearing, that's the third hearing. We have
November 30th?
November 30th.
At 2 p.m.
2 p.m. All right, we're in recess. Another.